Following are comments on Ben Jonson's Volpone, or The Fox, Act 3. Act 3, Scene 1. Oh, your parasite is a most precious thing. Mosca steps out in soliloquy and praises his own skills as Volpone's clever servant. In Act 3, Scene 1, our fly, Mosca, shows us that he is a more complex and dynamic creature than we could have guessed. Quote unquote, oh, your parasite is a most precious thing dropped from above, not bred amongst clods and clodpoles here on earth. Act 3, Scene 1, lines 7 through 9. It may startle us to see Mosca step into the spotlight and bespeak himself so boldly, but that is no doubt because until now, he has done such a great job of remaining behind the scenes and serving Volpone's interests. What Mosca says, by way of praising himself, illuminates the nature and role of a parasite as he sees it. Fundamentally, he describes his position as involving a core level of selfishness that easily rivals that of Volpone and the men, that is, the vulture, crow, and raven, who pursue his wealth, even as he pursues theirs. The finest parasites, says Mosca, aren't just in it for the table scraps or the tips. No, he says, the best one, quote unquote, had the art born with him. Act 3, Scene 1, line 30. This claim may remind us of the Roman tagline, Poeta nascitur non fit, a poet is born, not made. In his 1528 Book of the Courtier, or Il Libro del Cortegiano, the 16th century Italian Renaissance writer Baldassare Castiglione described the perfect courtier as practicing a kind of, quote-unquote, easy-seeming grace, which nicely translates the Italian term sprezzatura, spelled S-P-R-E-Z-Z-A-T-U-R-A. Mosca seems to capture the essence of this quality when he says that as for the true parasite's art, he, quote-unquote, toils not to learn it, but doth practice it out of most excellent nature. Act 3, Scene 1, lines 31 through 32. In Sprezzatura, there's an interplay, perhaps, between artifice and nature, but the artifice itself flows from natural felicity of word, dress, gesture, and action. Whatever amount of effort goes into a courtly or parasitical performance, then, seems not like vulgar straining, but instead seems to come, and for the most part really does come, naturally. Renaissance Italian concepts aside, our first look at Mosca, man and parasite, here in Act 3, Scene 1, tells us that we should expect him to exploit his supposedly superior overlords until he begins to take command of the play's action. For a good while in this play, Mosca will ride the desire-driven chaos he partly sows, mostly for his own benefit. Act 3, Scene 2. These imputations are too common, sir. Mosca steers Corbaccio's son, Bonario, from contempt to appreciation when he informs him of Corbaccio's plan to disinherit him. In Act 3, Scene 2, Mosca springs into action when he meets Corbaccio's son, Bonario, meaning in Italian, good man. At first, Bonario distrusts and despises Mosca, thinking ill of his groveling ways with his superiors. But Mosca is more than a match for the innocent Bonario, and he turns the situation around deftly by informing him that his father is just about to cast him aside in his will in favor of Volpone. He says to the young man, quote unquote, this very hour your father is in purpose to disinherit you. Act 3, Scene 2, lines 43 through 44. Now Bonario is hooked, and Mosca prepares him, if the thing be possible, to hear his own father proclaim him, quote unquote, the common issue of the earth. Act 3, Scene 2, lines 63 through 64. Of course, Mosca neatly avoids mentioning that he himself is the rascal who suggested that Corbaccio should inflict this very injury on his son. Act 3, scenes 3 through 5. Lord, how it threats me what I am to suffer. Volpone's enjoyment of the diversion provided by Nano, Androgeno, and Castrone is followed by the entrance of the philosophical chatterbox, Lady Would-Be. In Act 3, Scene 3, Nano, Androgeno, and Castrone kick things off by entertaining Volpone, who is waiting for Mosca to return. Nano articulates the subject of the entertainment, which concerns which of them can claim precedency, quote-unquote, in their competition to please their employer. Act 3, Scene 3, Line 6. Nano seems poised to win since he sings or recites some verses arrogating to himself all the best qualities and advantages over his rivals. Soon, though, Lady Would-Be shows up, which distresses Volpone no end since he considers her a pointless chatterbox. Quote unquote, Lord, how it threats me what I am to suffer, he exclaims. Act 3, Scene 3, Line 31. In Act 3, Scene 4, Lady Would-Be does not disappoint in her capacity to hold the conversational floor, referring to just about every ancient and modern philosopher under the sun, in no particular order. She drives Volpone into notably sexist paroxysms of self-pity and despair. When will this talkative woman depart and leave him in peace, he wonders in anguish. Finally, in Act 3, Scene 5, Mosca rescues Volpone by falsely claiming that Lady Would-Be's husband, Sir Paul, was last seen rowing through the great city's canals with, quote-unquote, the most cunning courtesan of Venice. Act 3, Scene 5, Line 20. That's all it takes to send her off in pursuit of her allegedly wayward partner. Meanwhile, Mosca continues to place himself closer to the center of the action. He has undeniably got Volpone out of a tough situation with Lady Would-Be, and now he leverages that good deed by playing the bearer of excellent news. Quote unquote, Corbaccio will arrive straight with the will. When he is gone, I'll tell you more. Act 3, Scene 5, Lines 33 through 34. Upon hearing that, Volpone declares, quote unquote, My spirits are returned. I am alive. Act 3, Scene 5, Line 35. Act 3, Scenes 6 through 7. Oh, I am unmasked, unspirited, undone. Mosca positions Benario to overhear Corbaccio disinherit him, but instead, Corvino shows up early to offer his wife Celia to Volpone. When that gambit fails, Volpone tries to rape Celia, but is prevented by Benario. In the very brief Act 3, Scene 6, Mosca hides Benario in a spot where he expects to hear himself disinherited by his father, Corbaccio. Benario has trouble taking in this betrayal, saying, quote-unquote, Yet cannot my thought imagine this a truth? Act 3, Scene 6, Lines 3 through 4. The action that transpires at the outset of Act 3, Scene 7, however, is different. Corvino arrives early to offer up his wife, Celia, to the carnal enjoyment of Volpone. Mosca thereupon sends Benario off to sample the books in a gallery at some distance from the present spot. And then Corvino and Celia get into a protracted tussle over what he expects of her and how it reflects on him. Poor Celia shows us that she is utterly clueless about the true nature of her conniving husband, Corvino. At one point, her invocation of masculine honor as a reason not to serve her up to Volpone draws the Falstaffian response, quote unquote, Honor? Tut, a breath. There's no such thing in nature, a mere term invented to awe fools. Act 3, Scene 7, Lines 38 through 40. For those who are familiar with Shakespeare's Henry IV plays, it's impossible to miss the similarity between Corvino's cowardly scoffing and Sir John Falstaff's brazen assessment of his attitude towards military honor. Quote unquote, What is honor? A word. Falstaff ends his shameless catechism, so-called, with the wonderful ante-sententia, quote unquote, Honor is a mere scutcheon. Norton Histories, Henry IV, Part 1, 687, Act 5, Scene 1, Line 134, and Lines 138 through 139. Things only go downhill from there, with Corvino offering Celia specious bits of egotism and relativistic drivel, and responding to her continued defense of virtue with what can only be called the force of a violent imagination. At one instant, Corvino threatens Celia as follows, quote unquote, "I will drag thee hence, home, by the hair, cry thee a strumpet through the streets, rip up thy mouth unto thine ears, and slit thy nose." Act 3, Scene 7, Lines 96 through 98. All this because Celia dares to sustain the concept of chastity that Corvino himself has been using to control her every movement. From her raging husband, Celia, unable to escape, is delivered to the miraculously revivified lecher Volpone, who at once enters into a long and distressing rhetorical performance to overcome the lady's unshakable virtue. Volpone serves up a Carpe Diem-style song inspired by the Roman poet Catullus, whose fifth ode begins, quote unquote, "Vivamus mea lesbia atque amemus." Let us live, my Lesbia, and let us love. This poem fails to move Celia from the firmament of her goodness. Volpone's offer of himself as a virile lover and opulent provider to replace the unworthy Corvino also fails miserably, as does the fox's straightforward contempt for the kind of virtue that Celia so steadfastly maintains. Ditto for the litany of erotic role-playing scenarios he trots out, hoping one of them will spark something in the less heaven-tending, more exotic parts of her imagination. All of these shifts fail in the most humiliating way, provoking Celia to offer her longest speech of the entire rhetorical battle. In the course of that speech, she invites Volpone to destroy the beauty that supposedly incites him to such immoderate conduct. She begs him, quote unquote, "Flay my face or poison it with ointments for seducing your blood to this rebellion." Act 3, Scene 7, Lines 251 through 253. Volpone's answer to Celia's plea is truly disgusting. He says in exasperation, quote unquote, "Yield, or I'll force thee." Act 3, Scene 7, Line 265. And with these words, Volpone attempts to rape Celia. Just as he begins this attempt, though, in rushes Bonario, who proceeds to play the hero. He denounces Volpone and says he's only refraining from killing the man so he can render him over to justice in the courts. Volpone is plunged instantly into despair. His rash and criminal assault on Celia's virtue, he feels certain, will be his ruin, and he cries out, quote unquote, "Oh, I am unmasked, unspirited, undone, betrayed to beggary, to infamy." Act 3, Scene 7, Lines 277 through 278. Act 3, Scene 8. Let's die like Romans, since we have lived like Grecians. Mosca pretends to be deeply distressed at Volpone's present downfall, but continues acting in the service of his own interests. In Act 3, Scene 8, Mosca says what we would expect him to say to Volpone. He apologizes abjectly for the recent disastrous turn of events with Celia, even offering Volpone his throat to be cut and insisting, quote unquote, "Let's die like Romans, since we have lived like Grecians." Act 3, Scene 8, Lines 14 through 15. But by the end of this brief scene, when a knock is heard at the door, Volpone follows Mosca's advice to jump back into bed and play the invalid once more. Act 3, Scene 9. "You are his only, and mine also, are you not?" Mosca must manage both Corbaccio and Voltore at the same time, while still advancing his own and Volpone's interests. In Act 3, Scene 9, we see Mosca navigating deftly in a whirlpool of competing interests and passions. Corbaccio hands over the will, disinheriting Bonario and making Volpone his heir. But Volturi hears what's going on and flies into a rage. Even so, this vulture is easily convinced that what Mosca is doing is actually, however it looks or sounds, for the success of his suit. Mosca tells Volturi that his plan to expose Corbaccio's will trading to Bonario was for his good. The son, he explains, might have done violence to his father, and both thereby would lose out on Volpone's inheritance. He says, quote unquote, "My only aim was to dig you a fortune out of these two old, rotten sepultures." Act 3, Scene 9, lines 38 through 39. Volturi believes it all. Such is the power of desire to underwrite even the most obvious misprision. Mosca also draws Volturi into his lie about how Bonario forced Celia to make up a story about Volpone trying to rape her. Since Mosca knows that Bonario has said he intends to turn Volpone over to the Venetian justice system, he is enlisting Volturi in an attempt to delay or turn away justice altogether from Volpone. If Volpone goes down, of course, nobody inherits his wealth but the state. And with that consideration, the third act comes to an end. Thanks for listening. This audio lecture was recorded on Monday, June 30th, 2025. The foregoing material is copyright 2025 by Alfred J. Drake. For quotations, I have relied on the revised Methuen New Mermaids edition of 2019.